the reason these disturbances, they followed you to a new home, is because it's not the house that's haunted. It's your son.
So 1,100 men went in the war. 316 men come out. The Sharks took the rest June the 29th, 1945. Anyway, we delivered the bomb.
Never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, say, I'll be right back. Because you won't be back.
You get another beer, you want one?
Yeah, sure.
I'll be right back!
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Oh, shit.
My name is Robert Hawkins. Approximately 7 hours ago, something attacked the city. You found this. If you're watching this, then you know more about it than I do.
California, stay away from me. Stay away from me. I'll come in here. John Doe has the upper hand.
And on that day, Ahab will go to his grave, but he'll rise again within the hour. He will rise and beckon that all save one shall follow.
They're all gonna laugh at you! They're all gonna laugh at you!
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the US of A, and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how are you, sir?
I am well.
And in the state of New York.
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how's it going?
I'm fine, Phil. How are you?
Doing all right. And in the state of Massachusetts.
Hey, everyone. This is Abe here.
Abe, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well.
Excellent. Who we are, for folks who don't know us, we are Dark Discussions Podcast. If this is one of your first times listening to us, we talk about genre film weekly, critique, and review. Basically, films such as horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, techno-thrillers, mysteries, cult films, art house films, midnight movies, and such. Also, we try to talk intelligently about a genre that deserves intelligence. A lot of these films get bum raps, and now sometimes they're considered good films after the fact. So we try to talk intelligently about them. Now, our website is darkdiscussions.com. Our email is darkdiscussions@aol.com. Please email us, and we will read your email on the podcast. And also, you can follow us on Twitter, but most importantly, there's a big discussion at Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group. Just search for Dark Discussions Podcast on Facebook and join the fun. Eric, what else can people find on darkdiscussions.com?
They can find a bunch of stuff. They can find articles that we've written in the article section. They can find every single episode of Dark Discussions, as well as all of our spinoff podcasts available free for download. They can also find a link to our Patreon page. Patreon is a service that allows you to support your online artists. If you'd like to help us offset the cost of producing this podcast, you can follow that link on the front page or go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions. For every $5 a month that you care to donate, you'll have the opportunity to submit a topic for us to possibly cover on the podcast. We draw all the entries on a quarterly basis. For more details, you can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions or follow the link on our front page.
Excellent. All right. So I guess we have a bunch of house cleaning things and stuff, but we'll discuss all that at the end of the episode. So let's get right into our movie tonight. So, Eric, what are we going to talk about tonight?
Tonight, we are going to be discussing a movie that is currently in theaters, and we're only going to be discussing this movie that's currently in theaters. We are certainly not going to delve into any of the source material. And we're going to be talking about Pet Sematary.
In the woods today, L.A. discovered a charming little landmark. The Pet Sematary.
A place to bury our pets and remember them. Might seem scary, but it's not. Perfectly natural. Just like dying is natural.
The whole town's been using this place for generations. Folks make a kind of ritual out of it.
It's not some campfire story.
Saw these in the trees up there.
They're warnings. The local tribes carved them before they fled. They fear that place. there's something up there. Something that dates way back. Those woods belong to something else. Something.
That cat was dead.
That brings things back.
Cheers.
I know what you're thinking of doing. But they don't come back the same.
Daddy.
Who's? What's going on?
Hug your daughter.
I should never have shown you that place. Your child is not the only thing that will come back.
The barrier is broken. We have a second chance.
Sometimes dead is better.
That's right. Pet Sematary is a 2019 film. It is based off of a Stephen King novel from 1983 called Pet Sematary. This is also a remake or reimagining of a 1989 film, which also was called Pet Sematary, based off of the book. The movie itself actually is interesting. It's basically directed by... I guess somewhat up-and-comers, even though their last film and the film that put them on the map is already 5 years old. But Kevin Kolsch and Dennis Widmeyer, the directors of the film Starry Eyes, which actually stars one of our favorites of the podcast, Maria Olson. That film got rave reviews.
I didn't realize these were the same guys. That's cool.
Yeah, it is. They were basically the directors of that film, and that was a pretty highly successful cult film from a few years ago, and actually I think made Dark Discussion's top 10 horror films of the year. The screenplay here for this film is written by a guy named Jeff Bueller. Not familiar
Bueller.
With him.
Bueller.
Exactly. That's what, exactly. The film actually has a fairly decent cast, or at least the three leads anyway. Jason Clarke, Australian actor that's well known to both drama and genre fans. His probably biggest genre film was probably The Planet of the Apes, the second one. Amy Semetz kind of made it big when she finally broke into the cast of Alien Covenant. And this is her... I guess co-lead with Jason Clarke, and then of course John Lithgow, well known to everybody, but probably most loved by genre fans for season 4 of Dexter.
Hell yeah,
is right.
Though also the Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Okay,
there you go.
So you got
could also go Raising Kane.
Two. I'm just saying, you have two Planet of the Apes actors. Just
that's true. Yeah. You're saying the truth, man. You're saying the truth.
Just saying.
This film actually has a few other people of note behind the camera. Let me list who they are. Christopher Young was the composer, and he's probably best known for, at least for genre fans, for Hellraiser, the music for Hellraiser. Cinematographer is Laurie Rose. Is known for the genre film Kill List, English film. Production designer is Todd Chinevsky for Gingersnaps, is what he's probably best known for. And then the editor is a woman named Sarah Brashar, who actually is coincidentally the editor of a film that Eric just watched the other day, The Post. So there's some pretty well... known both in genre and mainstream cinema behind this film, besides the people in front and the directors and such. So that's pretty much all I have here. So I guess we can go around and discuss how we heard about this film and what we thought about it. So let's start with you, Mike.
As always, with any one of these major theater releases, I found out about it because I have a pulse. I saw it on opening night. I saw it on Sunday night with my wife in a local theater, and it was moderately well attended. But I got to be honest, I wasn't that thrilled with it. It was an okay film, but I don't think it was a terribly good adaptation for reasons we'll get to later. And I've seen a lot of people splitting hairs, and it's driving me insane about, is it an adaptation of a remake of the movie? Is it a remake of the book? Is it really a remake? Is it just a new adaptation? Is it just, you know, the reason all these
people have way too much time on that.
Yeah, well, all this split, people forget all this splitting hairs about, is it a remake? Is it a readaptation? All that came about because the term remake at some point got a bad odor. And so they tried to basically take the word remake and put a new spin on it. It's a readaptation. It's a reimagining. It's a recreation.
It's a reboot.
It's a reboot. You know, but at least a reboot when you have something that is a legitimate reboot.
It's not redundant.
That is a continuation.
That was good, Phil. That was
Thank
good.
You.
Right. Something that's a continuation or a sequel is different. If you're basically telling the same story again, like John Carpenter's The Thing, or The Fly, it's a remake. I don't give a shit whether it's you're remaking the book, it's a fucking remake. It's just a remake. This is a remake. I don't think it's a particularly good remake because I think they missed
the point. Let's stop talking about it.
Right. I think they missed the point, the filmmakers, of the story and kind of undercut the point of it. But a lot of that comes to the ending, and we'll have to wait till we can get into spoilers to discuss that.
All right. Very well. Eric?
I think I saw this on a Sunday morning. It was okay. I don't think it's a fantastic movie. I don't think it's a horrible movie. They made some changes to the story that I don't really care for. However, given that those changes were made, I think it was executed fairly well. This one is going to have to go to, we're going to have to wait to get past the spoiler flag to really get into stuff.
All right.
I thought it was decent, but I would probably not, you know, don't rush out to theaters to catch it. It's a Netflix watch.
All right. Very well. For me, I actually saw the film Sunday afternoon. I think it was Sunday afternoon with my father. I was honestly not too excited about it because I had seen the casting prior, and I noticed that it was going to be different than an adaptation that I was hoping to be, which would be closer to the book. So I was not looking forward to this film that well. Oddly, the film started getting rave reviews before it was released. At one point, it was up to 88%. The convention circuit and like the month before.
Yeah, right before. The
it had 88%
leading up to it. Yeah.
All right.
It had 88% Rotten Tomato reviews.
Not anymore.
Not anymore. No.
And then it got released. Yeah.
Yeah, and then it got released. I wasn't excited about it, but that 88% was like, that's interesting. But I still, I knew there was going to be changes. I went in and saw it with my father. And Eric is right. I mean, as a general film, it's decent. I mean, if you don't know anything about the story, Pet Sematary, it's okay. But I personally felt this movie was complete rubbish. It literally took a beloved source material that I was hoping to see a film based off of, and they made it something that wasn't actually the source material. I don't even think it.
So, Phil, let me ask you a question about
this.
Yes. We were texting furiously about this last night.
Indeed.
Would you have enjoyed the movie if it was called Dead Things?
Yeah, I see your point. Well, and that's the thing. It's you know what? I think I would be like you, Eric, and give it a C+.
Okay.
Yeah, so as a film, just as a decent horror Netflix horror film, yeah, that's fine. So it's a C+. But knowing the source material and going in hoping to get a fairly well made story based off of that, and finding out that it's not that at all, and it's just called Pet Sematary with some of the characters with the same names, I felt it was complete rubbish and disappointed completely.
So I just want to clarify that you're not necessarily slamming on the quality of the movie as it was made, but you are disappointed in the missed opportunity for a better adaptation.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you one thing. Even well-made story, because, I mean, the acting's great, the directing, the cinematography, the editing, and, you know, everything else is great. The screenplay sucked, I felt.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, so the screenplay was bad, even as a standalone film, meaning if it hadn't been adapted from a source material, I still felt it was a mediocre script or screenplay.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's my opinion. Abe?
So, like, Phil, I had already, you know, been quite well-versed in the source material, so I couldn't, so going into this film, I already knew from how the way it was advertised in a number of ways that the film would be diverting in a different direction of its story. But I was still willing to see, you know, see where they would take it, you know. How would the story go at this point on? You know, how would it be its own thing? And I think I'm right there with everybody else. It's an okay movie. I don't think it's a very good adaptation. Even if the changes made, there were some things that felt well, it wasn't very strong in the storytelling aspect. The first chunk of this film felt like a SparkNotes version of the beginning part of the story.
What's SparkNotes?
It's basically
CliffsNotes.
CliffsNotes. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A competitor.
Okay.
Yeah, it's basically that. It's basically CliffsNotes. It's basically just showing. The synopsis of the first part of the story before we finally get
old.
And so before and basically a quick summary. You know, everything is the one thing that really bothered me about this was the way it was paced in the beginning. One thing that about Pet Sematary is that it's a very slow burn novel, and it's not exactly fast paced.
That's with most Stephen King novels.
Yeah, but what I'm saying here is that they tried to turn into a fast pace by skipping through a lot of the character moments. This felt like more plot than what character.
I'd like to talk more about that later, Abe.
Yeah. Okay. But it's a well-made film. It's well-acted. It has some great shots, some cool, creepy effects. But, yeah, I think it was not exactly a very strong film. Not a terrible film, but I definitely, yeah, it's definitely a Netflix watch. I wouldn't go rushing out to the theater again. I think I have a lot more to say as we get into spoilers.
All right, very well. So that's Pet Sematary. Appears that most of us were lukewarm to this film, adaption or not. And we will get into reasons why and so forth as we progress through the podcast. But before that, Eric, do we have a wiki?
Wiki. All right. From IMDb.com. Dr. Lewis Creed and his wife, Rachel, relocate from Boston to rural Maine with their two young children. The couple soon discover a mysterious burial ground hidden deep in the woods near their new home.
Okay, that's somewhat odd because only Lewis discovers that, not the family, but
no, they're talking about the actual pet cemetery.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Yeah, so that's a fine. Yeah, I guess that's a fine wiki.
Well,
wiki,
actually, wiki. the whole family does kind of discover it at some point or another.
Well, oh, that's true.
Actually, you're right. This adaption is true. The book, not so much. Before we get into spoilers, some stuff before, you know, just about the film and whatnot. Having reread the novel in the past 3 days, the 540 pages of it, getting the idea to do it because of Abe, because he read it last week and I had read it 36 years ago, I actually feel that this novel would be an excellent miniseries
Well, and I was actually, Phil, you just you opened the door for what I wanted to talk about with Abe and you, for that matter, which is the process of adapting written material for a screenplay. Now, there are all sorts of different written works that have been adapted to the screen. I personally think it's easier to take a shorter written work and expand it into a full-fledged screenplay than it is to take a full-length novel like Pet Sematary and condense it into a two-hour movie.
Or hour and a half in this case.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Because if you were going to, you know, completely go, you know, word for word from the novel, it would be 16 hours long like the audiobook. Mm-hmm. So in order to adapt a novel to the screen for a movie, you got to cut some stuff out because you just can't have it all in there. It's just not possible in that runtime. So while I agree that this wasn't a particularly good job of adapting the material, Abe's comment about how it seemed really fast towards the beginning, some of that is kind of necessary just to get everything in.
But I think it was more to the aim of trying to get right into the resurrection stuff.
Right.
As opposed to the focus on the grief and the psychological deterioration of the characters.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, I think... Go ahead, Phil.
I was just going to say that on page... It took page 152 when Gage is not Gage, I'm sorry, Church. Something happens to Church, the cat. Mm-hmm. And so, as you can see, there's 150 pages of just development of the characters, and it specifically was the development of Rachel and her issues with death, as well as the Victor Pascal incident. And, of course, the relationship between Lewis Creed, the lead character, and his neighbor across the street, Judd Crandall. So 150 pages is all that before they even get into...
And it's not until 290 before Gage's death.
Before something happens to Gage.
Yeah.
No spoilers.
Well, I'm saying by the next section, by part two, we finally get into... You know, the tragedy.
But back to the point I was trying to make, the general rule for screenplays is one page of material equals 1 minute of screen time, and you can't have 250 minutes of screen time before that happens.
No, but...
But they're also written very differently on a screenplay versus a novel.
I know, but you understand the point I'm trying to make here.
Right, but it's... You have to pare stuff down. Have to. Mm-hmm. And I think a novel has lots of opportunities to do... little side stories or, you know, delve into people's thoughts and, you know, richer descriptions, you know, like you can spend three pages describing the town in this film. And I can't remember what the name of the town is.
Ludlow.
Yeah. Ludlow. You could spend three pages, let's say, describing Main Street on Ludlow, whereas the film will say, you know, exterior, Ludlow, Main Street, or whatever it is. And it's done. You know, that's... Or maybe a line right. That says quintessential, you know, New England town, you know,
right.
And, whatever.
And now I was not expecting a complete adaptation. I was not expecting, you know, I was.
Well,
I'm saying, you know, even the remake of It had cut some things away and it was still successful in that execution.
And it's also two parts.
Yeah,
but the book is also double. That's not true, Eric. It may be two parts, but it is 500 pages each part, and this was 500 pages of the first part of it, just as Pet Sematary is a 500 page
book. Right. I was trying to back you up, Phil, in your statement that this would make a good miniseries.
See, I don't think it would, because I don't think you have to include everything in it.
No.
I think you could get this in within a. Within a two-hour time frame, you can include the important material. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of things that don't necessarily need to be there or can be de-emphasized. I mean, the main things you have to hit, you know, you obviously – I mean, If I were to cut, let's say I was going to cut this down to the bone.
Wait, Mike, I got to stop here. Let's go ahead and throw up a spoiler flag, because it's impossible to talk about this without spoilers.
All right. So. Well, before we throw up the spoiler flag, I want to say that Mike isn't necessarily correct, because American Gods is a novel, and that is a shorter novel than Pet Sematary, and they're making it into a 3-season story. Now, obviously, there's weaknesses, Mike. We agree that, you know, they probably only needed 2 seasons, probably. But
it's also a story with dozens of characters.
Well, I understand, but I could explain the reason why I think this is a better miniseries than an hour and a half or 2-hour movie, because of some of the side stories, the idea of what drags people to do what they do in the movie. Well, and that's where, like Eric said, we need this probably the spoiler. So I can agree with that now, Eric.
No, I'm gonna say if this was let's pretend for a moment that this was a book that was written in, I don't know, 1920, and they were gonna make it into a film the same time period that they made Dracula or Frankenstein, and you only needed to get like an 80-minute to a runtime. You know, and you look at like, you know, Dracula or Frankenstein, they strip a lot of stuff out of those two novels to get those two films. You could cut away, you really could get away with cutting out, the Zelda storyline. You could get away with cutting out the jogger. I keep forgetting his name,
Pascal's
storyline. You could even get away with paring down the cast by getting rid of, certainly Judge Wife, who doesn't make it all the way through to the good parts of the novel.
Phil,
I know she's your Sansa. I got it. Yeah. And then listen to the year in preview episode for more on that conversation. And then and you could even get away with getting rid of the second child, right, with the daughter, with Ellie. And because what really matters,
they kind of do. an original source.
I'm saying to the original source, what really matters, and they do in the original source, right? What really matters is, is what happens to Church,
the parents, the kid, Judd,
the cat, and that's it. And you can you can put in a taut 90-minute thriller. It won't.
I'll explain why.
No,
you're
Phil, let me finish. You can get it a fairly taut 90-minute suspense thriller film with that. Now, there's other stuff you could go back. You can put those things back in. They can start enriching, enhancing certain themes. They flesh out ideas. You know, in this case, I felt like they kept those things in there because they had to keep them in there because people liked them in the book. And they missed using them to explore certain themes in the book that they completely just flushed down the toilet with the ending that they come up with.
So this is
a case of even, but anyway, I don't think it's necessary. And I don't think that this is a story that lends itself to a 2 or 3 night event where it doesn't start feeling like, I know, Phil, stop making sounds. It's over my talking, please. You know, without getting bogged down in lots of character development where everybody wants just to fast forward to the zombie cat.
And well, there's something interesting I want to throw in there. I couldn't help but feel I know Eric hates trailers. I know a lot of people don't like them, but it did allow me to catch some certain things that gave me the idea that some things were actually cut out from the final version of the film. Because there was actually a moment where we saw a little more of Norma as a revenant, actually.
In the trailer, you mean?
Yeah, during the moment where Ellie confronts Jude as an undead and tries to kill before he kills him, she morphs Norma's face and says, remember what she did to Norma and stuff like that. So it's referencing things, but things that were never talked about in the movie. People who read the book would know what she's talking about, but they've never talked about in the film at all. So it leaves a lot. I think it really leads to a lot of things that were.
I would agree with that statement.
I haven't seen the trailer, so I got no idea what the fuck you're talking about.
But even the Norma Revenant piece in this movie was kind of stupid, because the point of the Norma Revenant in the book was you already knew Norma as a character, and so. When the morphing happens in the book, it's hugely disturbing. While here, it's like, who the hell is this person that he's she's
well, because, well, it's also because the wife is only mentioned once in an old picture, and so they just brought up at the very last minute. And honestly, if Jude never had a wife, it wouldn't have made a whole lot of a difference. You just would have had the conversation right. with Ellie, and that would have been it. And they also got very reliant on using Zelda for a lot of jump scare scenes. When Zelda,
yeah, that was a little lame.
Yeah,
because when Zelda was only like, a, even though she was one of the creepier parts, she was used very sparingly.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the whole Zelda thing in the movie was just there to make some more scary things. While in the book, the Zelda storyline was to explain why the wife was the way she was, you know, behavioral health issues.
Yeah, because one of the themes of the book is acceptance of death and trying to get past it.
Right.
You know.
Right, and that's her experience with her first experience with death as a child, and that affects her.
Right.
Yeah, and you know that, and it, and I do like it. There's a little more conversation about it, but the thing is, I feel like the movie lacked patience because they kept using Zelda all the time to fill in the gaps where nothing was scary was happening.
Yeah.
You know, for the movie, I don't, based off of the movie they created, the Zelda character was unnecessary completely because the only point of the Zelda character in the Pet Sematary story book or movie should specifically be the fact that it leaves Rachel, the wife, somewhat damaged as it's from childhood from her experiences with the death of her sister.
And they did that, but they used it too much.
Well, I think they used it too much in the way they showed four jump scares. I don't think they used it very well in terms of effectively developing her as a character.
Right. Yeah. And then they also sensationalized it too by making her the way she died. It was sensationalized in the movie, while in the book, she died, just
choking.
Yeah, choking.
Waiter.
Yeah,
it got silly. I think the only...
Well, another thing, too, about that, Abe, was that the book really emphasizes how this 8-year-old girl shouldn't have been alone with a sister that needed medical attention. And that was like brushed over altogether. You didn't even know if she had parents.
Well, another thing too was also just, because there's a whole thing with the Goldmans and everything like that.
That was
brushed away. And I mean, that was completely neat, but it was another bit of details to, you know, Rachel's trauma. I think the way this adaptation was done, I definitely agree with what Mike said earlier, that they could have completely removed Gage because he doesn't go through anything except what happens to him in the novel. Ellie is the one who goes through the growth of dealing with death herself.
Right.
Yeah, and I didn't like that particular change to the story, and I also thought the direction they took it once they made that change was...
Yeah, I want to bring it up. I'm dreading doing this because I don't want to hear it again. But did either of you know the twist before you saw the film?
I
heard somebody.
Yeah, I heard
read
Jason
somebody
Lloyd,
ranting
yeah.
about it on
I,
Facebook.
They really did not try to hide that very fact. I mean, it's even on one of the posters, for fuck's sake.
Lloyd mentioned it in his little mini review on Facebook, and he said that it was okay with him because it was made it different. So I had just known that they had flipped them.
Well, it's not that it's not a question of the making the change, although we can talk about that. It's the fact that I think it's
the age difference is huge.
I think I think it's the marketing malfeasance of because the film clearly in a lot of ways is. Plays like look at the scene of the accident comes. It's playing on your expectation that it's Gage that dies.
Right.
Not well, because when you know the story, because if you know the story, thinking Gage is going to die, they do almost nothing with Gage for the first half of the film.
Actually, the second half of the film too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
he's not even necessary in this film.
Yeah.
Right. So
that out completely removed.
Well, except you get to have that last scene.
Right.
But
which is dumb.
Yeah, I'm just saying. So they really, so even if it was a matter of, ooh, we're going to try and fool the audience, they even kind of failed at that. But they were clearly were trying to fool the audience, and sure. Yet.
And now, why? But why do you want to even fool the audience?
I've never watched trailers.
Why do you even want to fool the audience?
But this is a terrible example of a trailer. But here's the thing: you could have taken this. Let's pretend. Look, if anybody who knows what Pet Sematary is,
yep.
Right, they know what to expect. You don't need to sell them any more on it, right. And so you didn't need to include that twist in there. And if anything, putting that little twist in there is going to get you the pissed off rants that you got from Jason Lloyd.
Right, and all you need to market the film is Stephen King's name.
Well, and then, right, so from the director of It, which apparently yeah. Somebody commented, they saw somebody in the theater say, oh, this is by
right.
The same guy
from the writer. It. Yeah, exactly. That's all you needed. So, yeah. Yeah. Even if they didn't even know who Stephen King was, as long as they knew.
Well, that was
my
point,
this,
yeah.
Yeah, that's what I
so,
would say on that, yeah.
But then for the rest of it, it's called Pet Sematary. The
yeah.
Book, for those of us old enough to remember the book when it came out, it was not sold on a dead child coming back from the grave. It was sold on the picture of the cat on the cover of the book. Mm-hmm. Right?
Both the hardcover and the softcover.
And it was a Pet Sematary. And I've got a hoodie with that image on the back, right? So it's you could have sold this film with just images of church. And the idea of the Pet Sematary and all this, and left all that as a complete surprise, no matter which child it was. Leave that as a complete surprise to people who don't know anything. Have them think they're going to see a killer cat movie, and it's actually yet another killer child film for this year.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Admit, though, thankfully, none of the children mentioned the word anus, so while sitting in a car.
I do want to speak to the cat for a second.
The cat was awesome. I really did. That cat was really cool.
Well, and here's the thing, is that it's not the same type of cat that we've come to be associated with Pet Sematary.
Mm-hmm.
The cat they had in this movie, it's a long hair, but the coloring of the cat was actually very similar to my cat, Piper, that I had to put to sleep about a year and a half ago. And there was a moment, and I just, this all came coming back to me, because this is all revolved around my Pet Sematary experience. When I put Piper to sleep, the vet told me, I'm going to give her the shot and she's going to fall asleep. And there may be some brain activity for a couple minutes afterwards. So there may be a twitch or two. So she put the cat to sleep and listened with a stethoscope, and the heartbeat was gone. So she told me she was gone and left the room so I could have a moment. And after she had left the room, Piper's back leg kicked. And for just a moment, I was just like, oh, fuck.
Jesus Christ.
Is my cat coming back to life?
Well, I'll say one thing about the cat in this movie.
Tuna, Eric.
I do think having the long hair was a good choice for a visual, because
you can make it look nastier.
Yeah.
Because of the matted hair and all that stuff. So that was a smart move.
Yeah. And the cat was really cool. I really liked it. Especially when you do comparison, when you had him at the premiere with his little bow tie. That was actually fucking adorable.
That was hilarious.
My wife complained. She said, because if you look in the film, they actually use four cats. She said, it's not fair. There were the other three.
That's eight.
Or whatever it is. They said, why is it only one cat got to go to the show? I said, because it was the only one willing to wear the tie.
Oh, and that could probably handle crowds. So.
Yeah.
So when we start talking about the pet cat and bow ties, this movie wasn't that good.
Now, there's another thing.
It's got nothing to do with the movie.
Come on. That was a funny joke.
There was another thing that they kind of altered was the way that the undead worked.
Say that again.
Well, another thing that they changed from the book.
Everything?
Yeah, but there's also...
That's not true, Phil. It's not even close to true.
There's a chunk. But there is something, it's the way the undead work. Because in the book, the undead are basically husks with something inside them, some kind of demon.
Right.
In this case here, though, the undead are fully aware that they have come back.
Right. Also, this Pet Sematary, not the Pet Sematary, the Micmac Burial Ground, which, of course, they're not going to use Micmac in the movie because it's politically incorrect. I agree with you, Eric, but what Mike just said.
That is.
So basically what it is that the Micmac Cemetery is like has a possessional force. The Wendigo that lives there basically can start hypnotizing people similar to vampires, and that's what causes people to do the stupid things that they do, even though they know they shouldn't be doing it.
Yeah, it compels you to. As one thing is because there's a point that when they try and bury Church in the actual pet cemetery, Jude turns because he hears whispering, and this is a hint towards the influence of the pet cemetery. But you would not really understand that at first if you didn't read the book, because he only kind of barely touches on it when
right.
he's earlier conversation.
Yeah,
but they go into an entire conversation where they're talking about Timmy Baderman.
Timmy Baderman. That was an awesome. That's why I think this could be a miniseries.
Well, the thing is that it's a great chunk of the mythology of that this environment, this world, this burial ground is in kind of way that leaves a lot of questions and doesn't really lend itself to explain some things. Some things can be changed here and there, but I think it really hurt the film in a way because
it wasn't well explained. You're right about that.
Well, that's the problem.
Even in the first movie back in the 80s, they did, they had the backlight on the Deadfall.
Yeah.
Which was a pretty good visual and explained that something was going on there.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Yeah, at least that visually explains something. While here, they didn't. Yeah, that's a fair point. Not that, in my opinion, was a good movie either. But.
Well, and the other thing that hurt this movie is the they mostly, they had it in there a little bit, but for the most part, they left out the whole part with the Victor Pascal character taking Lewis on his adventures.
He only takes him once to the pet cemetery, and here it was done in like 5 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And the book, that's why it could be the miniseries again, is that in the book, it's so awesome and spooky. And then the cleanup the next morning where he's like, holy shit, it actually wasn't a dream.
Because that's what people want to watch is someone cleaning his dirty sheets.
No, but you think it's a dream, and then suddenly you find out it's not, and it's like, that's pretty cool. But the thing is that here, in this movie here, they just show it for 5 seconds, and we still don't even know why Pascal even was in this movie. Like Mike said, it wasn't even necessary.
Well, he's not in the book very much. He's used more in the original film. He's there. He says
what it is. What happens, Mike, is in the book, you're right. He only shows up twice at the beginning, but then at the end of the book, Ellie begins to have dreams about him, warning her that your dad is in trouble.
Yeah.
But we don't see him because it's through her perspective, and the book isn't through her perspective. It's through either Judd, Lewis, or Rachel. And so,
And I don't think he's all that. I don't think we need an explanation, which is why I don't think you need a miniseries. I don't think you need to expand on it. We're already dealing with a weird mystic place. He comes back as a warning. They drop a line. I don't know if it's in the book, but they drop a line in both films, about maybe it's because I tried to help him, he's trying to help me, or something like that.
That's what you learn in the book, yeah.
Okay, I don't remember they said that. So that passes. You already got spiritual stuff going on here. Someone who just passed over who's trying to say, hey, spooky shit, your backyard, you own the property. They didn't put it on the lease. Whatever. So that's good enough for me, and just giving a warning. You don't need much more of that other than him coming up and just adding a little bit more spooky atmosphere, because it is a very visual thing. So I don't mind them playing that up more in the film, because it adds a little bit more spookiness and atmosphere to it. It's an easy way to do it, but it's also not completely essential either. You can tell the entire film story if Pascal wasn't out. It wouldn't necessarily be as rich, but it also wouldn't necessarily hurt the story in any big way either. And it was fine. I thought, it worked here, it worked there. But I don't know. Again, to what effect? I don't know. It's just, there's all sorts of things with this where it felt like they were doing a lot of perfunctory stuff, and you talk about the pacing.
Well, Abe, Mike, you know what it is? It's since it's not even like the book. Let me rephrase that. A lot of it isn't like the book. Why add things that are from the book if you're, you know, you're cutting out other things? So why do they just have the Pascal thing?
Because
in there
some
in the
things
first...
work differently in a visual medium than in a printed medium.
Yeah, but yes, yeah, well, that would make you think. Well, it's not going to work. So let's just cut this whole piece out.
Like, well, no, because you also have to deal with fans, and fans want, like, Zelda in there. They want Pascal in there. They want certain things in there, too.
People sit around screaming about how it's not exactly like the book, don't they, Phil?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It didn't have the things I wanted in the movie. So
yeah,
why,
some
I
people
don't...
say that the least important character in the book is the most important character in the book, in the movie. You know, just they can't have a good movie if they take out that least important character in the book. Then suddenly it can't be a good movie adaptation.
Okay, we're done slamming on you.
all I know is that yes, they may have these people that are going to complain about Pascal and Zelda, and if they're not in there, they're going to be pissed. But that's insane logic, because it's like you kill Ellie instead of Gage. You cut out the entire, you know, I mean, it's just so stupid. It just doesn't,
given
the logic
given,
doesn't make
given the other changes that were made, I see your point there.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. The big changes don't happen until the last third of the film.
Yeah. Yeah. That's where a great deal of, you know, the divergence comes in. And there's also, mentioned earlier about the trailer, they were also showing a lot more of those kids in the mask. In the trailer, which is kind of
that was weird.
That was stupid.
What I'm saying is that I feel that there's been a lot of chopping up going on here.
What the hell was the mask thing? So
they're
they
just
find
trying
out,
to make a creepy image. Creepy. That's all.
Make it more creepy, and it's like it's stupid. Yeah,
yeah.
You're not going to see kids doing that. That's just
there was a thing in the book that they mentioned that there were processions for the Pet Cemetery.
Yeah, it's 120 years ago in 1880.
Maybe I could see kids burying their pets. I can't see them walking.
Not wearing their fucking
settle
mask.
Down, Phil. Let him get
breathe.
A sentence out.
Breathe, will ya? What I'm saying is, I can see them doing processions, maybe. I can't see them wearing creepy fucking masks. That's fucking ugly.
Right.
And I was saying in the trailer, they were showing a lot more of them in hauntings and stuff like that, and they're not in that, which is good. But it really gives me the idea that there was a lot more. There was substance to the film that was removed, and maybe that's why some of the bits of pacing felt off.
Yeah, I would have no trouble, especially I thought, and I know some people were complaining about the kids in the animal masks, and I didn't have a big issue with that. I kind of figured that it was going to be one of the flashback sequences of Judd telling the story before I knew they were
right.
going to boil all
Which
that down
been,
to.
Would have been okay.
To an internet search. But I also don't necessarily have a huge objection to it in present day, because if it's a town tradition, you know, and if parents are giving their masks to the kids, I could see that. I mean,
I don't even know where that came from, because it's not even in the book, really.
Phil, could you
in the
stop?
Book, in the book, in the book, book, book.
Take a drink every time.
I'm just saying,
in the
because
book.
It's just to add some atmosphere, and that's, again, it's a visual thing, so it may do something a little creepy visually. It's all right. It didn't do much for me anyway, but all right, fine, whatever. You know, it's not a reason to hate the film or dislike the film. It was just doing something that was different from the book or the original film. That's not a reason to dislike it. It was a thing. Some people it worked for, some people it didn't.
Well, yeah, as a whole, you're right. You don't dislike the film as a whole because they had this stupid creepy scene that wasn't creepy. Roll my eyes and go, this is stupid.
But this is a case of, again, whether it works for you or not. You know, but they're trying to build some air of mystery to this and what's going on. And again, you have to assume that there will be a significant chunk of the audience, you know, especially if they're young, that has never seen the original film and has certainly never read the book. So they really don't know what this is about. And this is sort of to build an air of mystery to it.
But you don't really need a mystery for a Pet Cemetery, do you? It's just a cemetery.
They're trying to... Okay. It's called atmosphere, Phil. It's trying to build suspense. It's trying to build inquisitiveness. Because if you just say Pet Cemetery, then there is nothing to it. But when you show kids in masks showing this ritual, and ritual is something, and I've always said this you know, that ritual can be an important part of horror, can certainly add to it. And I always bring like The Exorcist up as an example of that. And that's, I do think, something that this book betrays, but it's one of the, not the book, the movie betrays, but I always loved just even the ritual of Pet Sematary was the idea that you had to be the one to bring the, whatever it is, to the pet, to the burial ground. You had to be the one.
Micmac,
bury
yeah.
it.
To the right, to the Micmac burial ground.
Each one bury his own.
Yeah, you have to dig it up. You have to bury it. Yeah. You have to put the stones on top that you picked up with your bare hands. It's all about not just what happens, but who does it. And that's an important part of the tradition, you know, and how the magic works, or at least how they believe the magic works, and how it works in this film until you get to the end of the film.
To quote the book, what you buy is what you own, and sooner or later, what you owned will come back to you.
Right, and no one's complaining about it. I'm just saying, as a scene, and yes, I understand that a procession with masks can be creepy. I just felt it was a little silly, is all. That's all.
So let's talk about the big change. The big change, and this is full spoiler flag now, folks. The big change in the story here is that in the original story, the was he two in the original story?
No, they've been saying that online, but he was at, by the time his death happened, he was three or close to four.
Okay,
around there.
So in the book, the little boy Gage is the one that dies, and in this movie, it's the older sister. That's the one that dies. And here's, and I'm going to let me go on for a couple minutes here before anybody chimes in. Given that they made that choice, I thought what they did with Ellie once she came back to life was okay. I liked her one fucked up eye. I thought that was really cool. And I liked the creepy ballet dancing. That was also pretty cool. However, I don't like the change in and of itself, because there are two big reasons. That one is that it's just, to me, inherently way more creepy to have the smaller child running around killing people.
especially when he can't communicate.
Right, well, yeah.
As a child.
And,
but, you know.
And also... this book was written as of a lot of Stephen King's work, based on events out of his own life. And one of the main events that inspired the writing of this book was when he rented a place, you know, by a road with a lot of trucks. And at one point, his own child was running towards the road, and he was like, you know, everything turned out okay, but his mind kept on turning it over and over again. What if? You know, what if he hadn't stopped running towards the road? And that was really, it's really the bedrock that this story was based on. So because of that, I thought that was like probably the one thing you don't want to change at all in this story.
And it's done to change. It's a change to throw the audience off. It's, well, they already know that. Let's change. This is sort of like doing a remake of The Shining, but having Shelley Duvall's character going insane instead of Jack Nicholson's character.
Right.
Yeah. Just because you're doing it just to do it. And you know that's the only reason you did it. You only and that's, you know, it's sort of like there's a scene later on in the film, the ankle scene.
Yeah.
The Achilles tendon scene.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have an issue because it's a minor change, but it's where they have a setup where everyone's expecting, you know, the child to be under the bed to cut Judd's Achilles tendon, and surprise, he's not there.
Well, he didn't do that in the book, but in the movie,
the original film,
the 89 film.
Okay. Right. So what I'm saying is that that was being done to play with your expectations, and that I don't mind because sometimes you do want to play with those expectations. But this is a minor deviation. This is a major deviation.
Well, and that's the thing. It's like, why even make an adaption of a beloved work, never mind a movie that's become a cult film since 89, and change it so drastically to fool an audience or be unique or whatever, when no 90%, well, not 90, but a good percentage of the people who are going to see this film aren't people who have never heard of Pet Sematary. Most of the people that have probably seen this film are people either that read the book or seen the original movie. Yeah. So it's like,
I don't know about most, but well, a good percentage.
But a good percentage. So so a good percentage of those folk want to see a better adaptation of the last movie.
They're not putting their wife back in.
An adaptation of a film of the book. So that's better. So when they come in and they see this, they go, this.
Well,
is
here's the other thing. Is that after they made that change, they committed to making everything different and fundamentally changed the story.
Yeah.
Right. And that's a problem.
Well, yeah.
Because originally the story is about these people that are compelled to take the loved ones who have died and bring them back to life, even though they know they're not going to be the same. But it's this compulsion where in the end of this movie here, it's like, I don't know, zombies trying to perpetuate zombies. I don't know what the hell they were going for here.
Yeah, because the basis of the whole horror was like, if you had the power available to you to undo something, would you do it, even though it will go wrong? That's the psychological horror of the story. Because in the novel, Lewis is told in detail why this is a bad fucking idea.
Right.
He's told in complete detail, don't fucking do it. Don't bring your kids up
to Henry G. the Bull and Timmy Batterman.
Yeah. And, you know, he says, don't do it. But the whole thing is Lewis is so pulled to do it because he feels like maybe, just maybe something will be different. But, yeah, as I said, not just the Reverend's characters have changed, but the whole cycle of the whole thing's place of how it acts is now to create a zombie plague now, it seems, because they're now burying people and stuff.
Well, and that's the problem with this adaption is it's not a true adaption of a story that is beloved.
Well, it's not a straightforward adaptation. It's a very loose adaptation. And I think it's just too loose. And I think, again, what's wonderful about the book, and I am by no means the Stephen King authority here, but when I was really into King and read a lot of his stuff in the 80s and the early 90s, this might have been my favorite book.
It's awesome. Stephen King book ever.
And it's one that really stuck with me and creeped me out. And unlike It, which really stuck with me and creeped me out, and then Turtles and Spiders and what the fuck is going on? So it's where It to me was like a 2/3 of a great book. You know, this was a really good book beginning. So this one is one that means
you
a lot to me.
You can say it's great, Mike. You don't have to say it was.
But so this one's a good one from beginning to end. But the idea is it's the whole thing, everything goes with ideas of how do we deal with death? You know, how do we, you know, learn to deal with death and how do we cope with it? Or do we learn to cope with it? And you have the mom who has trouble coping with death because of what she went through as a child. You have just the idea of the Pet Sematary, right? Of this is how many children first really learn about death, is having to bury a pet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is pets are basically hold on, I got to cover my cat's ears up here for a second. death is, you know, pets are basically death practice for children, right? I mean, this is how what you're going to have to do to mommy and daddy one day.
Mm-hmm.
Then you get hit with the most people who are not teachers would say is the ultimate tragedy, which is the death of a child. And how do the parents, specifically, how does that affect the parents? And you have one parent who simply cannot cope with having to bury his son.
But
right,
supernatural thing is pulling him though.
Oh, but it's one of these things that, you know, it's sort of like, I don't know, the monkey's paw. You know, it's this thing where it's playing on your own desires, and you know, it's something that I don't, you know, it's something that's there in the first place.
But I think every parent would have those same desires. It's just that no one would do what he did unless they were possessed by
the Wendigo.
You know what I'm saying. At least in this adaption, the character was kind of being possessed by the Wendigo.
Right, but I mean, I've known people who've lost kids, and I'm sure we all
have. My mother and father. My father read this book and bawled his eyes out because he said when Christopher died.
And all you need, it's like putting the bottle in front of the alcoholic, that you don't have to say no, you know, you don't have to say yes every time. You just got to say yes the one time, right? Mm-hmm. And so as long as he's living there, as long as that temptation is there, and he knows that it's there, you know, he just has to be weak for a moment and go through with it. And the demon, the Wendigo, whatever it is that's motivating him, that's enticing him, it's not making him do something he doesn't want to do. It's making him do something he knows he probably shouldn't.
There's also a bit where
every parent would, if they had a choice, would want their child not to have died.
And one of the benefits of the book, one of the benefits of the book is that it puts you in his head and you get his rationalization.
Yep.
Right. Well, we waited. He was dead too long, right? It was dead for weeks. He's only been dead like a couple of days, you know, and then later, well, she's only been dead a couple of hours, you know, and so it's this desperation, and it is, I think, a true nature of humanity that we always rationalize away our worst instincts, our worst behaviors. We find a way to say it's really not that bad.
Well, there's also a bit in with Jude even says at one point, you'll come up with the sweetest reasons to go back up there. You know, you'll come, no matter how bad it gets, you'll come up with the sweetest reasons to travel up there again. You know, and that's what happens. Lewis, each time, no matter how Church turned out, no matter how Gage turned out, he kept finding out reasons, even at his, after everything, he had lost everything, to just go back up there. His desperation to fix on the just even the slightest bit. And it was also it's an escalation of not being able to accept when something has gone wrong in life.
But the question is, if the Wendigo hadn't possessed him, or even Judd for that matter, to bring him up there in the first place with Church, would he have done it? And based off of his sanity prior to all of what happened, I would have said that he probably wouldn't have. But because everybody wants their family members not to die, you're always going to think that. And then when the possession comes in, the Wendigo comes in, then you're going to do it. And that's the problem.
And it's, again, anybody will do it. I think you can argue, well, he was a 2-year-old or a 4-year-old, barely verbal, where she's a fully grown adult. And she, you know, so you can rationalize anyway. It reminds me of some of the papers I had to read in college where, like doing research, and you get somebody doing the experiment, and like and the experiment clearly disproves their hypothesis. And at the end, they say, well, we need more funding. We need to do more research on this to really know for sure. It's like, no, dude, just, this is like the third time you've done the same fucking experiment. Just accept it. It's over. It's not going to work.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it is. And that's the problem with this, is that part of it is that they fast forward through the grief too quickly.
Yeah. That's because in fact, in the book, the novel, the story is a huge chunk of it is a focus on Lewis's grief and his deterioration. The undead child stuff is only like 40 or 30 pages in the novel.
That is correct.
It's such a focus on him falling apart and being unable to accept what has happened.
Well, it's and also the pull of the Wendigo.
What I'm saying is the very fact of the matter is they don't spend a lot of time on the build up. They go it happens so fast. We had the accident, and immediately, almost like maybe less than 7 minutes, he's already dragging her body to the burial ground.
Well, that's because they changed the entire last 20 minutes of the movie to be Rachel fighting off Ellie.
To summarize what this whole discussion we've been having here, the original story was about human nature and how we process death, and this movie is about zombies.
Pretty much.
And the key is all of that is emotion. Right, it's not rational thought, it's not theory, it's emotion, it's feeling, and they shortchange so much of your feelings in this film. And I'll just give you another good example is Judd. Now, I love John Lithgow. I really do. I think he's a fantastic actor. I can watch him act in just about anything.
Fred Gwynn.
Well, and here's the thing. I completely forgot, God rest his soul, Fred Gwynn within a couple of seconds of this film. And I said from the beginning, so that when I if from the trailer, I said, you know, I think I'm going to have a hard time seeing Lithgow as Judd. Because especially he doesn't have the accent. But I said, but maybe like once I see it in the film, it won't be a big deal. And honestly, it wasn't. I was just rewatching the original film here. When you first meet Judd here, he's a cantankerous kind of old bastard. Yeah, he pulls the stinger out of Ellie's leg, you know, but it's not, you know, there's no warmth.
No.
And because you never get any inner dialogue, you never get, you know, extended scenes with him, you don't have his wife there and all these other things to humanize the character, you really need the actor to give a very warm performance, where you see Judd in the film, in the original film, the first thing you see is him stop Gage from getting run over by the truck in the first place. Mm-hmm. And he's got that big old Herman Munster smile.
Yeah.
You know, he's inviting, you know, like the next thing you know, he's on the porch drinking a beer, you know, with Dad, and they're, you know, he's like,
he's like another grandfather. He's a best friend to Lewis, and even another father.
Right, he hands him the beer, and he says, "You can I get you a glass?" And he says, "No." It's like, good for you. You know, just sort of good man drinking right out of the bottle. They build up his warmth. He's a and so when Church dies, you really feel that he would feel badly for the family, for the children. And he would maybe – he doesn't want to see them suffer. Here, it's sort of like, do you want to bury it in the pet cemetery? Yeah.
Right. Well, and that's the thing. See, like the three adaptions of the story in the book, Norma has a heart attack, a minor heart attack, and Lewis basically saves her. And so the Wendigo, when it tells Judd to help Lewis bring the cat to get – resurrected, he uses that as the reason. You did a favor for me, saving my wife Norma. I want to give you a favor, and you know, we'll get Judd Church back alive for you. In the original movie, it's like you said, Mike. The you know he feels bad for him, and then in this one,
it's because he has to court for the plot.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah, because and there's only like one scene of you know before that the whole burial of Judd with the family, interacting with them at all.
Yeah, well, he's in like two scenes before that because there's a scene when he pulls the stinger out of Ellie, and which oddly,
Ellie in the house.
Ellie's not crying, which is like shocking. And then the scene at when he has Church on his lap.
Yeah, right? Yeah, but they're very quick scenes and they don't really give enough of a connection. And there's even less one between Lewis and Judd. You know, so you can't really feel like warmth or trust between them.
Right. There's no scenes of them having beer like in the book.
And it makes Judd's death in this film so weak. You know, it just happens. It doesn't really have the impact of seeing poor Fred Gwynn getting his face sliced open, his throat ripped out. You know,
or the character in the book that we loved.
Yeah, being stabbed over and over again after having been tormented the memory of his wife and stuff like that.
By all his friends,
but you know it doesn't have that blow to it. It just occurs and Lewis has the reaction like he burnt his toast when he finds his body.
Now I don't know if this is because when I think back of most of John Lithgow's performances, and I could be missing some, I don't get a lot in my head of warm and sentimental characters. So maybe this was a case of miscasting.
You know what's odd, Mike? I always used to think he was a warm type of actor until the Dexter. In other words, I felt Dexter was a great casting for him because it was not typecasting, because I always looked at him as the opposite than you looked at him.
No, I mean, I always saw him as a smart guy, but not like, well, again, Fred Gwynn, you know, as Herman Munster, right? Was just sort of, you know, huggable, cuddly daddy, even if he had bolts in his neck. you know,
I don't know. I don't think the casting was a bad choice at all.
But I think it's more. But I'm going to guess because I think he is a great actor, and I've always said I think actors can do more than what they're typecast to do. I have to assume that this is the way they wanted him to play the character.
What do you mean? I didn't feel his character was played bad at all. I mean, what was wrong with how he played the character?
Well, that what are we even talking about anymore?
We're talking about John Lithgow as Judd. Was that a good casting?
Well,
I think it's fine myself.
Well, but again, there was no warmth from him. There was no sense of emotion or feeling between him and the characters. Whereas you could do it more shorthand, the way that you did Fred Gwynne.
But well, I don't think that was the problem at all. I think he was only in the film for like 10 minutes.
Well, but I think it's also some of the way that they played him. I don't. He also came across as a little bit more of a prickly character, I think.
I don't know. What do you think, Eric? Lithgow as Judd.
It's fine.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Abe? What did you think of
I definitely see the prickliness of this portrayal. He seemed a little more abrasive at first, and he will kind of warms up as where Fred Gwynne's Judd is a lot more open armed. So there was a different approach there.
I think you're right, Mike. I think he was told to play it the way he did because I just think the screenplay sucked.
Yeah.
Now, since we're on performances, what do we think of what's the opinion on Clark and Smith's performances as the Creeds?
I thought Clark was fine. Smith's was fine too, except her character was nothing like the character in the book. So
yeah, I don't think acting was the problem.
Yeah. I think again, it's all the screenplay.
Yeah.
I
thought they were okay overall. I think maybe the reaction to the death was a little underdone.
Again, I think it was the screenplay. Like you said, Abe, you were the one that specifically said it, which is they did the grief in 2 minutes and then they moved on.
It probably was screenplay. It's just, and I think that really hurt the performances because I mean they were good, but they just weren't allowed to flourish as well as they could have.
Yeah, I would agree.
I've liked Clark since I think I first saw him in a Showtime series called Brothers about Rhode Island politics a number of years ago with Jason Isaacs, and I thought that was a really good show. So that's how I remember him from. I think he's a good actor. I think he did fine in this. And one of the things I'm in rewatching the original film is just how not entirely fine the original actors were in those parts. They're a little stiff and wooden. So I think the parents here do a better job, but they just, and maybe it's, I don't know if there was a lot more to the film that was edited out as you were alluding to maybe, Abe, but the way the what plays out on screen is just done everything in such shorthand. None of the emotion feels earned. So even though they do a decent job playing it, and I did actually get the relationship, and the affection that Judd had for Ellie, that certainly came through.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get the sense that they gave a shit at all about Gage because
Gage was more of a prop.
And Gage could, as Mike mentioned earlier, he could have been omitted from the film entirely. It could have been just Ellie's a sole child.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, and it's this whatever version of the story we're talking about. Really, only one of the kids really matters in the end.
Right.
Yeah.
What's funny though, Eric, is the only reason Rachel heads back to Maine in the book is because Ellie begins to have all the same dreams as about Pascal. And then she's fairly important that way. And also she's the one that pretty much builds up the whole beginning. Ellie does with death and the confrontations they have, the parents have because of death and all that. So,
she's important because she's the reason they bring Gage back, right? Not Gage, sorry. She's the reason they bring Church back.
Right.
Yes, that's true.
So that's the main reason she's there. You could just easily, which is what they did in the original film, is they give the visions to Mom instead of to Ellie.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So there's ways around it, but basically without having a child old enough to grasp the concept of death, which Gage isn't quite there yet, then you don't have a reason to bring church back. So they did do serve a purpose. It's just not the most wonderful purpose in the world.
Right. I mean, in the book, she's huge because, I mean, she's on almost every page. So she's fairly important, even more so than Gage up until the point, like you said, when Gage dies, Eric. So the family in the book is really well developed generally. And
right. And, not nearly as well developed here.
Yeah, that's the problem. And again, I'm not too familiar with the 1989 film because I haven't seen it for about 6 years, and I never was a fan of it anyway.
Didn't you say recently on a podcast that you changed your opinion of the film?
I think I changed it, meaning I didn't think it sucked, but it was okay, maybe. But it's not a film I would ever consider buying, or I got to see it free on Netflix again like 6 years ago. But sure. I'm not really a fan of it. And the whole thing with Pascal in that movie was absolutely stupid. It was making him a comic relief character. It was like, what the fuck?
Okay, everybody who's not Phil, we need to make a pact to never cover anything that's adapted from a novel that he's read before.
Well, I think Abe has been...
Because you just make this miserable, Phil. You really do.
I honestly think that Abe has been then more onto the book than myself.
No.
I just had my thing at the very beginning, and that was about it, I felt.
Well, I did tell you, just, you know, considering I just finished it recently, I thought I would, you know, share my thoughts on that. Because, you know, the book was an enjoyable, a hell of an experience. It was a good read, but I felt that the build-up to everything was the real payoff. This here was, as I said, the pacing was one of the major issues, and the way the script was handled, I do think it's direction and also things being removed, because I feel like from what I saw that was shown in the trailers that was not in the film, there were things that they intended to put in there, they got out, they chopped out, and I think that might have caused that kind of strange, unsteady flow.
Right, and you got to remember too, Eric. You know, Mike has mentioned the original film many times tonight too. So I mean, whether it's the film or the book, they're all going to be entangled together, just as a remake is always going to be entangled.
Yeah, so let's just not cover adapted material anymore.
And I'm just saying it's different ways of doing the same thing. This is the problem from what you were asking him earlier. Yeah, you can view the movie differently if it was called something else because it was something else. You know, once you're adapting something, whether they're doing this as a remake of the book or the film, and you know, it's. As if you've seen the prior source material, it's hard not to make that comparison. And certainly, at least not the first time. You know, it's sort of like the film critics who watched The Thing and couldn't help getting the Howard Hawks version of the movie out of their head, you know, while they're watching the John Carpenter version. You can't, and that no matter how much you might want to have it not impact you or not affect you, it does affect you. You know, I remember when Jurassic Park came out, there were a lot of people who, you know, we say, oh, I really like the film, but why did they cut out the aviary scene? You know, well, that wasn't going to bother you if you never read the book and didn't know about the aviary scene. You know, it's an unfortunate reality where you want to be able to judge it just completely on its own merits. Now, I think we've done a fairly good job of sort of dissecting the film on its own merits as well as an adaptation.
Yeah.
To show that I think this is an okay movie. It is atmospheric in a lot of ways. The performances themselves are fine. The screenplay is weak. The screenplay, I think, undermines itself in a lot of ways, or at least, again, what we see on screen. Maybe there was stuff left off the screen, you know, that would have...
There was one detail I caught while I was watching this movie that I just want to mention, because we spent so much time focusing on the negative here. I really like this detail at Ellie's birthday party. At one point in the background, you hear John Lithgow telling the story of Cujo.
Cujo, yes, I overheard that part. I love the little detail.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was.
Also, another positive, too, is I thought the cinematography, which, again, was by someone of note. I think the person that did I forget. I said it earlier. But either way, I loved how the daylight scenes were actually daylight, you know, beautiful, sunny summer day. And then at nighttime, They did the nice blue or backlit or whatever that, and it worked really well. So, unlike, you know, like for example, the Irish films we've seen recently where it's,
where they desaturated.
Yeah. Here, there was no desaturation during the day. It was just a normal day. And I loved how that was in this film. They didn't do any changes that would kind of,
at least not in that way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that was good. What else?
I really did enjoy her fucked up eye.
That was a nice little detail.
And that was one thing I was watching, and I was trying to figure out how they did it. Was it makeup? Was it digital? Was it just performance?
I think it was digital.
And it couldn't have been just performance. I doubt it was just performance because she's a 9-year-old kid or a 10-year-old kid. And even if they could do it with her, I don't think they were able to convince the cat to do it too.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
I think maybe a mixture of, you know, maybe some practical effects and CGI to make that effect. But I think it really would make sense because,
And that was in the book.
Yeah, because they mentioned that Gage's head was not only completely deformed from the accident.
His eye rolled up.
Yeah. His eyes rolled up, and there's also mentioned from Rachel's point of view that he looked like he was put together by cruel hands. He was all disjointed and stuff like that. So it makes sense too after you get hit by a freaking semi.
I actually took a photo of that page and sent it to Eric through text.
He sent me a bunch of pictures last night. Yeah, I enjoyed that.
I mean, if you're going to get hit by a semi, and I loved how the semi, it was more modern age, right? He was checking his cell phone or something.
There's a little detail of Sheena mentioned in Punk Rockers.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, he was using his iPhone to switch the song or something, and he wasn't looking, and he ran. But you know what? And again, I'm sorry to say the book, but in the book, he never sped in his life the driver, but for some reason he was compelled to do so, and he tried to suicide after. And so, and again, that was part of the lore of how the Wendigo set the whole thing up to make Gage die or someone die so that it would come to the burial. And that was what's cool about that whole story is that there's this evil that just is like sitting over that whole town. And
well, sorry, go ahead.
No, that was pretty much all. Go on there.
Okay, I was just gonna say another thing that was missing in this version is the conflict between Lewis and his father-in-law. Which I felt added a good amount of drama.
Wait, no, no, he totally gave him a look at the funeral.
Yeah.
Well, I'll say this: at least they didn't do him jumping into the grave. That was stupid in the original movie, because that's like over the top. Where I mean, that would be like on CNN: a person jumped in the grave.
There was a fight at the funeral, like in the
book.
But
there was a fight at the funeral. Yeah, in the book.
Yeah, you need to go to more Italian funerals, Phil.
Well, I don't know if they're jumping into the fucking grave, dude.
It's come close sometimes, but fights
Greek
definitely.
Makes people do weird shit.
Yeah.
Especially grief of a child.
But you're right, Eric. They take that all out completely. Also, I liked in the book that we find out that the wife comes from a Jewish atheistic family, and he comes from like a Methodist atheistic family. But their perspective on death, because of the little religion they did have, permeates a lot of the story as well. And obviously, it's very difficult to get that across in a film. So obviously, that was going to be yanked. But you're right. The whole issue with the father-in-law was gone, you know. And I mean, a lot of it comes through the Zelda story as well. But here they didn't even go over it, because part of it was like the father and mother are scumbags because they left Zelda alone and had the 8-year-old daughter taking care of a woman that needed a nurse, and is showing how much of scumbags the parents were. And of course, you know, they bring the Zelda story in, but one of the main points of that was how to show, you know, the fuck ups the parents were. And of course, you know, they don't even have that in the, in this movie.
Yeah, there, as I said, there's, I think that's one thing, as I said earlier, most of this movie felt like plot more than anything of character.
Right.
All right.
It just felt, yeah, it felt like it was moving too quickly, and they didn't hit the emotions they needed to.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. Well, before we do that, any scenes that you guys, what did you think of the Pascal's, was that prosthetics or was that computer graphics, you think?
I think that was practical. I think that wasn't going to be a difficult thing to pull off.
I have no idea.
The face was very swollen on one side, which maybe that's what you would expect. I don't know. But, you know, that gave me the sense that it was a, you know, an appliance added on.
Right.
You know, so I'm sure in reality it was probably a mix of two things. You know, there was, you know, probably like the eye was probably makeup put on, and then you use CGI to go back and
do the brain.
Brain, or
it could be,
remove
it could be
the
like
seams.
They do the whites in Game of Thrones, whereas they have prosthetics and then green patches that they can fill in later.
Right. Yeah. That's they could be something like that.
So it could be a combination.
Also, what did you guys think of, like, a lot of horror films, they do the flash-forward scene at the beginning, like the house burning and all that?
Yeah,
stuff.
I don't...
I didn't particularly care for it. I thought what they were showing there was a flashback, because isn't that how the story goes with what's-his-face Timmy?
Yeah.
I thought that was a flashback when they showed it at the beginning.
Yeah, that was kind of unnecessary. I really didn't think that was all that needed.
Yeah, I don't understand the point, and I don't understand why did they burn down Judd's house. You have a zombie family. Don't you think you'd want them to not be like having?
Oh, was that Judd's house? I thought it was their house.
No, they burned down Judd's house.
Well, you
know, weird.
I think it was to cover the fact that Judd's dead, right? I mean, that they can make it look like he burned his house down or something. I don't know.
You think the emergency responders would go, "Hey, aren't you the little girl that we picked off the side of the road a couple of weeks ago?"
We're
feeling much better now.
Yeah, thank you.
I got better. We're still scraping your brains off the pavement, though.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Like,
yeah, that.
Yeah, because like again in the book, sorry, Eric. when he's thinking of what people will say when they see Gage, he was thinking he would just, you know, pack up and without telling anybody, and they would just move to another part of the country and start over without telling anybody. While here in this movie, yeah, it makes no sense. It's like she's going to be there with her parents, who are now zombies too. But as long as they see her around, they're going to say this doesn't make any sense. She's dead.
Well, and I don't know. See, here's the thing. I don't understand the motivation of the zombies at the end of this movie. I really don't get it. And the fact that they're burning Judd's house down instead of their own really doesn't make any sense. I thought they were burning their own house down so that nobody would wonder where they went. You know, the house.
Well, where were they going?
It was well sold. Well,
I think they're gonna
stay.
That's
the whole thing. I don't know, Mike. I don't know where they're going. I don't know what their fucking plan is. They're fucking zombies.
Zombie vacation to Hawaii. God damn it.
Yeah, and
technically,
even
they're whites, maybe.
No, yeah. Fuck off with your white shit.
And even, you know, I get the sense in reading what Stephen King said about them changing the ending. He's like, it's a good movie. It works. It kind of felt like, I'm getting paid. What the fuck?
Well, you the know, reason I say they're whites, Eric, is because they have intelligence. They're not just walking dead.
You know what? Even the people who work on Game of Thrones call them zombies.
Yeah, I know, but but they're not really zombies because they have intelligence.
Blah, 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 blah.
So Return of the Living Dead,
blah 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 zombies.
but I don't even think they're zombies. I think they're like Abe said, they're demons.
Blah blah blah, blah zombies.
In corporal bodies. They're blah, demons blah, blah. In corporal bodies.
Blah blah blah.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I mean, beforehand they were like almost like Wendigo demons inside husk that were just
right.
Just perpetuate the cycle of death that they, you know, that kept happening. This was all, you know, that's what was going on at first. But yeah, as Eric's saying, it was like, what the fuck? Where the hell are they going to do now? They're going to just start a zombie parade? Why did they bury Jode in the burial ground?
Yeah, they really just fell on their face at the end of the movie.
Yeah, it was unfortunate because...
I mean, it was okay up until the end, and then the end happened. I was
maybe this is a prequel to the Addams Family.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't even watch. Yeah. Oh God. Yeah, I know you guys haven't watched, but the trailer for the Addams Family film that's coming out.
There's another one coming out.
It's an animated film.
Yeah.
So the style is a little closer to the Charles Addams original drawings, but the jokes are just lame.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh my God! It's
nothing,
so bad.
Nothing will beat that last that casting from the old live action ones.
All right, let's wrap up.
Yeah, yeah.
Before
we
get into this,
yeah, okay.
Yeah, we don't all right. So, any final scenes or something that we missed that anybody wanted to bring up?
I was just curious. Do you know was there like any kind of like a novelization of this film or something? Is there a
Well, to be honest, if they did make a novelization, it would be its own distinct thing. That's for sure.
Yes, that's true. That is a fair point. But it would come across as a Pet Sematary ripoff.
yes. Oh, by what's that company that does the ripoffs?
Asylum.
Yeah,
have
Asylum.
Have you seen
Asylum's version of Pet Sematary?
Have you seen there's a movie out already? It's Pet Graveyard. Yeah.
Really?
But if you watch watch the trailer for it, it's kind of like they start out by going, oh, look, they're doing a remake of Flatliners. We got to do a Flatliners role. That didn't do too well. But wait, there's a Pet Sematary remake. We'll throw a dead cat in there, and therefore it'll be...
Pet Graveyard.
Pet Graveyard instead of, Flatliners, the ripoff. It'll be Pet Sematary, the ripoff. That sounds an awful lot like Flatliners, the ripoff.
Did they spell Graveyard wrong?
Oh, I don't... They did.
Graveyard.
and to be honest, they probably just fucked it up. But
watching the trailer for that. Watch the trailer for that
No, I'm not going to.
Because you're never going to watch your. I want to know how they find people.
Never gonna watch the trailer either.
How do they find people to write these things that are that bad?
They pay them.
But there are good writers out there that need the money too.
But they're also band writers that mean money, and they do this.
Oh, money, money, God. Money. Yes. Any other things that anybody wanted to bring up that we may have missed during the plot of this film? Anything?
I think the young actress that played Ellie is promising, and I hope she continues to act.
Yeah, I think she did a good job for what she was given. I think she did the best she could.
Yeah, she was good. Yeah, again, the acting wasn't the problem. That's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Well said, Eric. We didn't really talk about the children, and the children are hard to always cast in any type of film.
And that cat will get an Oscar. That cat will get an Oscar someday.
This film found a really good actress, a young actress. So good call. All right, sounds good. So. Before we get into our final thoughts, we'll discuss any news or anything. Some of the news that were brought up already was Adam's Family cartoon film coming out.
Let me ask you this question. When did Adam's Family Values come out?
Who cares?
Yeah, who cares?
When we talk about, no, because you say another
well,
one.
Well, the lead act is dead. Rawls Jules died.
Right, I know that.
So it's been a long time.
Yeah, it came out in 1993.
Yeah.
It's been a long time since the last Addams Family films.
I can be proud and say I've never seen any.
Sometimes dead is better.
Sure.
Yeah. Well done, Abe.
We were talking offline before this episode, and I think Abe may not have been joining us yet, but... the new Hellboy's coming out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's getting terrible reviews. I'm hearing good reviews about the lead actor whose name escapes me right now from Stranger Things. But it's basically, he's fine, but everything around him kind of sucks. The movie is just badly written.
Yeah, it's getting...
David Harbour, that's his name.
Yes.
Which character does he play in...
Hellboy?
No, in Stranger Things.
Oh, he's the sheriff. The one who adopts 11?
Oh, yeah, gotcha. Yep. Yeah, so, yeah, it's getting really bad reviews. Neil Marshall directing. He's had mixed as director. He either has super greatest things ever or mediocre, and this appears to be one of the latter.
Mediocre is not what I'm hearing about it.
Yeah, I'm trying to be polite.
At least we still have Descent and Dog Soldiers.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. So we and a couple of Game of Thrones episodes.
Mm-hmm.
We were gonna The Wall and Blackwater.
Didn't you do Blackwater?
Blackwater too.
Yeah.
We were gonna possibly do Hellboy as an episode. We discussed it a couple of weeks ago, and then as we got closer and saw how poorly received we decided that we're gonna skip it.
Not saying don't go see it. Just be aware
just
that
we're not gonna see it.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I've got spring break and the AMC A+ pass, so I can go see it for free. But I would, if based on these reviews, I probably
break,
would not spend
aren't
money.
Aren't you going to be in Florida with a bikini?
Yeah, and they have AMC theaters in Florida near beaches.
Okay, all right, just checking.
It's not sunny 24 hours.
So, let's see. Any other news anybody wanted to bring up? By chance, anything to note?
Well, I think we missed it, the opportunity, by last week or 2 weeks ago, where the internet just completely blew up for like 2 days on the horror sites when it was announced that Mark Hamill would be voicing the Chucky on the new Child's Play film.
Oh, yeah.
And, well...
I never forget those movies to begin with.
Yeah, but before that, it was... Like, everyone just did a complete 180 on that because, like, I hate the fact that they're making a Child's Play remake. Ooh, Mark Hamill's doing it.
I mean, Mark Hamill's good from, like, Star Wars, but, I mean...
don't understand. He's a phenomenal voice actor.
Yeah,
no, really I understand he's an awesome voice actor, but he's not going to make me determine whether or not a voice actor is not going to determine.
No, you're
going to see Child's Play or not.
No, but he's got a large enough following as a voice actor. Forget, put Star Wars aside, and especially for what he did as his work as the Joker on the Batman series.
Yeah,
that piqued people's curiosity because people were before that saying they still have it's coming out in like 3 weeks and they still haven't cast.
You know what? They probably had it cast all along and they just held it on purpose.
No, kind of thing they don't do now until the film is voiceover. A lot of these films just save it to the end because you can sync it up. You don't have to have the puppet match the lips of the actor anymore because it's all done through CGI.
No, I understand that, but I bet you they had the contract for Mark Hamill.
I doubt it.
Months ago and they just held
this
on.
This is pretty typical.
All right, fair enough. Why? When's this movie coming out?
It's in the next
summer,
couple of months. Yeah, it's definitely coming out this summer. But it wasn't. But they already put the first teaser out there, and you would think you would want to put that in the teaser trailer for that, just to get people's awareness. So I don't think they would have sat on that when they had that news once they started advertising for the film.
Fair enough.
Other news for any AV enthusiasts out there who have a 4K system. They are releasing the 40th anniversary 4K edition of Alien later this month on the 23rd of April. So I have pre-ordered my copy and look forward to watching that.
I wonder if it'll have extras.
How much are you charging for it?
Oh, I don't know, 20-something.
No. If you order through Amazon, and they have that pre-order price guarantee, right now it's $14.96.
Oh, sweet. Then I guess that's what I'm getting it for.
Oh, wow.
Right, now... So if Phil could order it right now, it can go down even more. But
well,
it'll be available free on streaming.
Actually, during Black Friday, I bought the four movie set, the Alien set, for like $9.
And the next day, they announced they were coming out in 4K.
Yeah, but I don't have 4K, so I don't really care.
Yeah, no. See, this is one, and I've bought a shitload of Alien discs over my my collecting time. You know, VHS, and so now it's just I know because you can buy. I bought the quadrilogy when it came out on DVD. I bought it again when it came out on Blu-ray, and now you can get it for like every couple of weeks. It's $20 on Blu-ray.
Right now, you can buy the six movie set.
Right, I'm pretty sure if I wait, because I don't have 4K right now anyway. So I'm pretty sure if I wait 2 or 3 years, there'll be the entire box set series of all the films on 4K for $50.98.
Well, speaking of Alien, right. Eric, just 2 weeks ago, Disney announced that there will be more Alien films since now they own Fox.
Yeah, they're starting with Snow White meets the Aliens.
Speaking of which, they announced pricing on the Disney streaming service, $6.99 a month, which is actually reasonable.
That's really good because
that's what they've been saying all along, is it was going to be under 10.
Yeah, because Shudder is like what?
I didn't believe them until today.
All right. Well, yeah. I mean, come on. I mean, if you can pay $6.99 and get all of Fox and Disney and Marvel and all that, who's is that going to take Netflix down?
It's a better dealer than Hulu.
It's better than Hulu and Netflix.
Well, but Hulu is part of Disney too. So.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah, you're right.
And I think,
but I meant Netflix. Netflix just raised their prices. And it's like, fuck Netflix. I'll just go with Disney for $6.99.
Well, I think Netflix is in for a bumpy ride in the near future with this happening, and then Apple coming out with their own streaming service.
Yeah, and Warner Brothers is coming out.
They could lose some market share in a hurry.
Especially if Netflix raises prices, it's really going to start hurting down the line.
Right. The problem with Netflix, unless there's something about it, I don't know. Like, I don't know if they're like, I don't know, dealing with cocaine fields in Colombia or something.
But random.
But Netflix's problem is that all of its revenue is coming from the streaming service. So everything they do has to be paid for
through the streaming service.
Really?
I read an article today.
Yeah, they have movies.
They're still pulling in monthly $2.7 million on their disc subscriptions.
Right. And also they're now releasing or trying to release films in theaters too.
Which means that, yeah, but very, very limited. But because their whole model is to, which is what she was the actress that you were, had posted the article about was talking about, was that Netflix has been trying to destroy the theatrical release. Helen Mirren was trying to destroy the theatrical model. Is that
I don't know if they were trying to destroy it. They just weren't following it.
No, but they've said they want to undermine it.
Really?
If you want, is that you take $2.5 million is like one episode of Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, they are getting a small amount of revenue, but it's not a lot. You know, and it's certainly nothing like what Disney's pulling down with the Disney Network or the Disney Channel theme parks and you know, Infinity War and the Lion King remake.
You can't really compare anything to Disney. That's just not fair.
Right. But my point is that there's other revenue streams that so Disney can afford to keep those prices artificially low. Apple's making a ton of money off its hardware. It can
Amazon can do it too. Amazon.
Right. And Netflix is kind of, even if it's getting like a 10% share from physical media and cocaine and the rest of the stuff that it's doing, it's still mostly coming in from that streaming service, so there's only so much they can do with that revenue.
Well, that's true, but at the same time, Netflix went global, and I don't think these other services have yet.
Yeah, that's very much. And if you look at, I'm not saying they're hurting for cash, because last I checked, they had something like 120 million subscribers. Let me see what that is now. Is Netflix approaching 150 million subscribers now? I don't know what it is worldwide. I don't know if that's US or worldwide.
I don't either.
Okay, so yeah, it's,
let's say it's worldwide. Just
it is worldwide
discussion.
So 100, well, now let's say that everyone's paying $10 a month for that worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
Now obviously it's not profit, but gross, then you're talking $1.5 billion a month from subscribers. And again, compared to $2.5 million for discs, you know, so yeah, that's
if somebody
a lot.
Offered you $2.5 million, you'd say, yeah, that's not very much. Never mind.
Yeah, they can. I mean, that's,
well,
It's the old joke about the government, a millionaire, but again,
I think Eric's right. They're in for a hurting because, in theory, their competition is very minimum. So, you know, I'm going to subscribe to Netflix or maybe Hulu, and
I think they'll be fine. Yeah, though. They're nimble. They're willing to change, as they did when they realized that streaming was on the horizon.
Right.
They were like, "Uh-oh, this thing ain't going to work out in the long run. Let's get on this first."
Right. And yeah. Apple almost bought them out too, and that fell through like 2 years ago. So I think that's the reason why Apple.
I've actually read that was all rumors, and that was never actually discussed between the two companies.
Okay, so it was just more fake news.
Yeah, fake news.
Gotcha.
Yeah, it's here's the thing is that, and I'm skeptical about Apple as I would be anybody else jumping into this for the first time because they've never produced their own series.
Right.
And Netflix took a while before they really struck on their first like much watched shows, right? And and so it might take a while for Apple to get there. Maybe they'll hit it right out of the gate, which I think they will
because they've hired specific distributors and showrunners that have experience already. So I think they will.
I'm with Mike on being skeptical, but I'm going to give it a chance. I'll wait and see what the material's like.
Right.
Right. Well, when you have Oprah and Spielberg and all these other people back.
Now, they got big names for sure, during their announcement of their service, it was a little disconcerting that, A, they didn't actually have any, like, filmed material to show, and, B, they offered zero details on the actual service, like what the cost is going to be and how it's going to be available on it.
And right. I don't know how many of these people are in exclusives. I don't know if Steven Spielberg is saying, "Oh, sure, Apple wants to pay me money, great, but I'm going to save my really A quality material for somebody else, and I'll just give them my scraps." The Oprah thing, I think she was just doing like one documentary, you know. So it all depends. A lot of it's
it was one documentary film and then one documentary series.
Okay, so. You know, I don't know many people are going to do a subscription series season channel just for an Oprah documentary. So it's
it's all going to come down to cost, right? I mean, if it's $6.99, people are going to pay for it. If it's $20.99, no one's going to pay for it.
And I can see Apple in their typical manner putting a premium price on their service. So we'll see.
Just because they have a slick interface. we're going to sell you a remote control with one.
No, the most interesting thing about the launch of their Apple TV Plus is it's going to be an app, and the app is going to be available on a whole bunch of different devices, such as smart TVs and other set-top boxes. So in essence, they are killing their own hardware product here. They're killing the physical Apple TV with the launch of the Apple TV Plus app, which is kind of a weird, interesting move.
Well, because I think they're realizing at this point, people aren't fond of the ecosystem model. You know, they're limiting their market.
No, I think the problem is people don't want to spend $199 for an Apple TV when they can just buy a Roku or an Amazon box for $1.99.
That's part of it too.
I think that's the main reason.
Well, it may have been part of their plan all along, just like with iTunes, where at first it was Mac only, and then after they kind of figured out what they were doing with it, they launched on Windows as well. That could be what this is, that they had on their own device first, figured it out, and now are launching it everywhere.
Plus, also things like phone sales are slowing down. Obviously, they're still doing phenomenally on phone sales, but people don't feel the need to buy a new one every year.
Right,
the
they don't refresh every single update.
Yeah, and this isn't like when you had the iPhone 3 was the only game in town. Now you have an awful lot of people who have their Androids or their Samsungs and, you know, their Google phones. And so they pretty much have the Apple market. And I don't know how much people are flipping back and forth between the two.
Not a lot anymore.
Right. So I don't think that's an area of growth. So now if they want to get those people on a Samsung phone, well, fuck it.
They need to get an app on a Samsung phone.
They need to get the app. And they already know they got the iPhone people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Pam is going to keep insisting we keep buying iPhones, so we're going to keep buying iPhones. So,
well, they're good. They're real
good.
Yeah,
but I also hear everybody has, you know, say that the Samsung phones or the Android phones are also really good. Right. You know, they're all really fucking good, especially when you look at the phones we had 15 years ago.
Right. Well, right. I guess for me, I'll stick with Apple phones because I have purchased a lot of movies and music from Apple.
Well, and that's really where Apple's going to win on this whole equation, is they're giving, even if they don't succeed with their original material, this Apple TV Plus app is also giving people access to the iTunes library where they can rent and buy movies if they want to. So they're going to gain revenue with the app, whether or not they're successful in their own streaming service.
Do you know if the Apple TV app will also be available on Android phones?
I don't want to answer that off the top of my head.
Because that's an interesting thing.
I know
thing,
it's
right?
going to be available on a whole bunch of big brand smart TVs like Samsung, Vizio, Sony, LG. Right. I'm fairly certain it's going to be available on the Apple Fire, or not the Apple, the Amazon Fire TV devices. And I want to say Roku too, but I'm not 100% certain.
Yeah,
it'll
probably be Roku. Roku is pretty much a whore. It'll sleep with anybody.
I wonder if it'll be on like Xbox and all those things.
Yeah, that's what has me curious.
Yeah,
because
very possible.
Xbox, they didn't mention.
Right, yeah. Because Xbox and Microsoft are more of a direct competitor. In mm-hmm. their mind, still,
yeah.
From the yeah. Netflix wars, not from the Netflix wars, sorry, the Netscape wars.
Right.
Yeah,
it's really going to come down to options. The more options are available, the people are better off. Some people think they are when they make a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed. Yeah. Let's see.
My buddy Dan, who does the Scan State podcast with me, is rooting for a bundle. He wants Apple to bundle all the things they just announced, the Apple News Plus, the Apple Arcade, the Apple TV Plus. He wants them to offer them all together under a discounted bundle price. I personally don't want half of them, so I don't care, but that's what he's rooting for.
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, the main problem with cable TV, and the reason I hate it, is because you have to buy 95,000 stations when I only want three.
Well, yeah. And that's what all these streaming services are pretty much reinventing cable TV,
yeah. Right?
Because they all have different stuff, and if you want everything, you got to pay for everything, and it's all over the same thing. That's
right. And I don't have access to the actual numbers, but I also understand the logic of it, of what they've claimed, which is that you get so many people who want to watch the Chiller Network, you get so many people who want to watch the Golf Network. Neither one of them has enough of an audience just to get a loan.
But if you bundle them.
But if you bundle them, suddenly, you know, now you get enough people paying for it and enough potential eyeballs that now it becomes worthwhile. That makes a certain amount of logical sense, you know, but I also understand the point of view from the viewers. Now, the only way I can get, you know, a network which I don't really watch network TV anymore. But the only way I can get a certain channels that I want to watch is that I have to suffer having the Food Network. It's not a big deal to me.
No, that's a good network. That's a good network. I love the
that's
Food
Network. That's Giada. The network where they chop asparagus.
Yeah, Giada is on that. She's the best. I love Giada.
Oh, yeah, I had to go to the doctor.
This conversation has gone off the rails.
Yeah.
Any other entertainment news?
No, I guess. Oh, yes. The guy that directed It Follows, his new film comes out April 21st, which could be an episode of Dark Discussions.
What's it called?
It's
called In the Book. It's
called, I got it right here. It's called Under the Silver Lake.
Huh.
Stars James Garfield and Riley Q. It's a Topher Grace is in it too. It's what we call a psychological thriller. So
is Topher Grace being in a movie still a positive thing?
Probably, yeah. Maybe not.
Was Spider-Man? I think.
Yeah,
that would be Spider-Man.
Oh, Traffic. Traffic. I saw him in Traffic.
That was before then, I think.
But either way. David Robert Mitchell, the director. He's also the screenwriter.
It's not Topher Grace. That's Andrew Garfield.
No, he was
Topher Grace was in Spider-Man 3. He played Venom.
I'm saying in this movie, it's Andrew Garfield.
That's what I said. And Topher Grace.
Oh, okay.
I said Andrew Garfield and Riley Q star, and it also includes Topher Grace.
I don't see Topher Grace listed in the cast here on IMDb.
Yeah, he's in the cast.
All right. Well, then you know something that IMDb doesn't.
It's Rotten Tomatoes has him as the third lead in the film.
Well, there he is. If you click on the expanded cast, you get him.
Yeah.
He's like 20th listed on IMDb.
Oh, okay. Interesting. But either way, the film got rave reviews at Cannes and won an award there.
I forget. He did play David Duke in Black Klansman. I forgot about that.
Oh, that's right. He was actually pretty good as that, too.
Yeah. So, okay, that shut me up.
So either way, that's coming out. So that's exciting. That's one of I think I mentioned that on our 2019 upcoming list.
Mm-hmm.
So that's some news. And this is his follow-up to follows.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, speaking of Topher Grace, because I have seen this and I almost forgot about it. One of the scarier books I read in the 1990s was a book called Crisis in the Hot Zone, which was about the Ebola virus, and that was something that was going to be made into a movie, but they got beat out to it by Warner Brothers, who got managed to get Outbreak made, and right, Natural Geographic has picked it up to make it into a series starring Topher Grace. Huh. But that's coming out like any week now.
So it's going to be like a Contagion film.
Ooh, and no one else is in it. Sir Davos Seaworthy.
Nice.
There we go. His play is the lead actor is Liam Cunningham, Seaworth, sorry, and James Dicey, Noah Emmerich, Topher Grace, Robert Sean Leonard, Mark Kelly, Paul James. So yeah, there's some halfway decent, but not necessarily huge name actors.
Right.
You know, but I'll be curious to see how that comes out and the tone that it strikes, because that was a novel. That was one of those novels that back when Stephen King was a name that was even bigger a name than he is now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like scariest book I've ever read was like right on the cover.
Right. Yeah. Well, and you know, it's funny, too, is that Stephen King is probably as big now because of the It films. Right.
He's not. You know,
he hasn't not been big.
He's never been
as big as he was in the 80s.
Right. No, that's true. You couldn't get away from him in the 80s. He has had a significant resurgence in the last 5 years, though.
Yeah, but he was like the Beatles.
Right.
Yeah. He's more like Elton John, meaning he's still huge, but you know, no one really buys his new albums.
Yeah, exactly.
I do.
Yeah. So.
And you're still trying to get through one of them because you're only on page 4,987.
Well, yeah. I'll probably have to check that. What was the book he came out with last year that you said was good?
The Outsider.
Yeah, so I may check that one out. Yeah. All right. So any other things? Anybody want to bring up anything? All right. So let's go around. And you already mentioned it a little bit, Eric, but you actually do another podcast with your buddy Dan?
I do. It's a general interest podcast called the Askancy Podcast. That's spelled Askancity. You can find it on Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google. Nah, I already said Google Play. Spotify is the other one.
That's right. That sounds good. And Eric, you also are doing another podcast with me and Mike.
Oh, shit. Yeah, we got to talk about that. I think we're doing that Monday.
Yes, we are.
Yeah, we're coming back with You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, a Game of Thrones podcast. Only a few episodes left to go in season 8. Then it's going to be done. So come join us to talk about each episode on a weekly basis.
Excellent. And Mike, me and you actually do another podcast. You also have like a blog or something?
Yeah. Well, we're also doing Searching for American Gods. We just completed episode 5. And we just have 3 more episodes to go, 6, 7, and 8, which is somehow going to be doing at the same time we're doing the You Know Nothing Jon Snow podcast, so that'll be fun.
Now you guys get to know what it's like to do 3 podcasts a week.
Yeah, well, just wait. we're going to get you to four before you know it. I've actually been, because I've been on the Dorkening's Wicked Horror Show for the last 3 weeks.
Ah, okay.
Because I made the mistake of recommending three movies and directors to them, and they invited me on to do all three interviews. So we just got done recording a nice interview with Mike Lombardo of I'm Dreaming of a White Doomsday, which I'm sure everyone's sick of hearing me talking about. And the week before that, we had done Theater of Terror, and the week before that was The Killer Clown Meets the Candyman. Theater of Terror I talked about earlier, and you know that's available if anyone's looking to theaterofterror.net. It's a fun anthology film, definitely like an 80s callback. And Killer Clown Meets the Candyman you can find in the convention circuit and film festival circuit, and it's a pretty disturbing film about Gacy and Dean Corll, and it's not going to be for everybody, but anyway. So those were those. But yeah, I also have my blog, which is on natural selections, which I update, you know, annually at this point.
It is annually at this point, isn't it?
Kind of.
Very good. I want to let folks know that they can find a couple of short stories that I've written that are in some books you can buy on Amazon. One of them is a book called Invocations. I have a story in there. Included also are stories from Mark Preston and Patrick Lacey and Christy Peterson Schoonover, and Dan Lynch writes the foreword to that. Basically, Invocations, something to do with supernatural incantations of bringing demons and whatnot back. My story is a little twist that doesn't actually not have any supernatural in it at all. So you should check that out. I think it's one of my better stories. Also, you can find Pentagonal Sextet, which is a
pentagonal.
Thank you. I screwed that up again. Pentagonal Sextet, where I have five stories along with five other authors, meaning five stories and six authors, Pentagonal Sextet. I have five horror stories in there. It's a good collection of stuff. People should check that out.
But folks, buy the book. Phil has two children. He's got to get through college.
Yeah, that's right.
Also, I have a short story and a book called Chud, that basically is in the Chud movie universe. Folks should check that out. That's a pretty good, anthology. Chud Lives, a tribute anthology, it's called. And then I actually have a new short story that just came out in a book, or it's about to come out at the end of April, and you can pre-order it, but I forget the name of the anthology.
It's called In the Book.
So I will have to find that out later, but mine is about two female warriors that go after a necromancer. So it's a fantasy anthology, and I decided
definitely
to
sounds
go.
Like your fancy.
I wonder if the women are scantily clad.
Is one of them named Sophie?
No.
Sophie and Taylor.
I forget the names. I wrote the story last summer, and you know how those things you submit it and you have to wait and then finally.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
And so I can't even remember the two lead characters' names, but there one's a knight and one's like a paladin type person, and they're off to find a necromancer who. Also is a woman.
You mean necromancer, not necromancer.
Whatever.
he writes words. He doesn't say them.
Exactly.
Yeah. But basically, I'm just talking about a short story that's an anthology, and I get attacked by three people, but what are you going to do? All right, so Abe, where can people find our podcast?
You can visit us at darkdiscussions.com and find the episodes there. They're all free to listen to. And if you want to check out something else, look on the right-hand side. You'll find blogs and other sites to visit and the other podcasts we've mentioned in passing. So just type in darkdiscussions.com and pay us a visit and say hello. You'll have a good time.
All right, very good. Hopefully people will come and check out the website. Anybody that wants to donate to Patreon would be great help. Of course, we're on Dark Discussions Podcast on Facebook. Join us there, and please send us all your emails. Let us know your opinion of Pet Sematary and what you felt about it, as well as any changes between that, the original movie, and the book. Anything you think we didn't cover that you would want to give your two cents, please send it over to darkdiscussions@aol.com, and we'll read it on the podcast. With that stated, let's go around and give our final thoughts of Pet Sematary. Speaking of Pet Sematary, what say you, Mike?
Mediocre movie, bad adaptation.
All right, very well.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Eric.
What Mike said, same thing.
Use your own words.
No, okay. You stole mine.
You fucking plagiarist.
I will do Cubed.
Okay.
Abe.
Yeah, it's not a great film. It's decent if you try to let it stand on its own, but its adaptation, it falls flat. So I think we're all on pretty much the same page. But I do recommend checking out the novel. It's a great read.
In the book.
And I would concur with that statement there. With all that stated, Eric, why don't you do this out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in and listening to us talk about Pet Sematary. Come back next week. We'll have another topic.
I don't want to be buried in a pet cemetery.
Fuck was that?
That was the Ramones.
Oh, okay.
Well, no. No, it was not. It was
it was Abe.
That was the Abe Bones. Oh my God.
Under the outdoor where the sea falls, it's your garbage and what I will know. Come at the grand line making a stand. The smell of death is all around. And at night when the cold wind blows, no one cares, nobody knows. I don't want to be buried in a pet cemetery. I don't want to live my life again. Addicted to the sacred place. This ain't a dream, I can't escape. Moldings and fangs are picking up bones. Spirits moaning among the tombstones. And at night when the moon is bright, someone cries something ain't right. I don't wanna be buried in a pet cemetery. My life again. I don't wanna be buried in a bed.